May it please the Court, Kate Aronson, representing appellant Rashawn Owens. Good morning. It's undisputed that two bank robberies occurred at Sun National Bank in 2005, one on February 28 and one on March 28. The facts of the robberies were generally consistent as they were supplied by the four bank employees. There was, however, no evidence, physical evidence, that Rashawn Owens participated in the robberies. The only evidence was from the testimony of the co-defendant, Quinn Martin, and from Aaron Ray, an accomplice in the receiving stolen property charges in Aston, PA, when they are arrested with red dye-stained money, but he is never charged in Delaware. Quinn Martin is without question tied physically by evidence to both robberies. His fingerprints on the note from the February 28 robbery, his fingerprint is on the interior bank door of the March 28 robbery. The gun seized from Troy Wiley's house and registered to Rashawn Owens did not match the description of the firearm utilized in the March 28 robbery. Sarah Arnold, the customer service representative who was held at gunpoint, described it as double-barreled, the firearm that was purchased legally by Mr. Owens more than 5 months prior to the robbery was a single-barreled firearm. All of the evidence concerning the plan and or plans to commit the robberies, the participants in the robberies, and who did what after the robberies was supplied solely by the testimony and the uncorroborated testimony of Quinn Martin and Aaron Ray. And pursuant to Bland and Smith, at an absolute minimum, the jury should have been instructed to scrutinize Martin and Ray's testimony with great caution, and that the jury should...
But you agree that no request was made for that instruction?
That's correct. And this case is on direct appeal. And typically this court does not consider an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And the state actually disagrees with appellant regarding the standard of review. The state has argued that it is a plain error review. But the record is absolutely clear in that there is no request. And based on the testimony in the case and the record, the uncorroborated testimony of a co-defendant and at least an accomplice in a receiving stolen property case is the sole basis or is the sole evidence against Mr. Owens. So this court held in Cook and in at least one other case that when the record's clear, the court can reach a Strickland analysis without...
What about Hoskins?
Well, the court declined in Hoskins to reach the ineffective assistance of counsel and reviewed it on a plain error. However, the court noted in a footnote that it was a viable claim. And quite candidly, in the interest of judicial economy, when the record is as clear as it is in this case, it's the appellant's position that the court should reach the Strickland analysis.
But the only thing's missing is we don't have from defense counsel an explanation about whether it was strategic, whether it was discussed with the client.
In Smith, this court adopted the appellant's argument that there is no reasonable objective explanation for failing to do so. In this case, on its facts, with the testimony being the sole evidence of Rashawn Owens' guilt, as it was in Smith, there is no explanation that any trial lawyer can give on post-conviction that it was reasonable not to ask the trial judge to give an accurate, correct instruction of the law. There's no explanation for that that can be given.
Is that your primary contention, that is the Strickland argument, or is it the essence of the argument, the failure sua sponte to give the Bland instruction? I mean, the two seem to be floating around together, and I'm not sure which you're relying on.
I am relying on trial counsel's failure to give that instruction. I'm sorry, to ask for that instruction. I'm sorry.
Okay, so you're not claiming that the judge's not giving that instruction in isolation is the basis for a claim of error.
Correct. In Smith and in Bland, this court held the trial counsel's arguments in closing are only that. They are arguments, and they're not an adequate substitute for a correct instruction on the law.
Well, even under Strickland, assuming that we could entertain that argument, there has to be a showing of prejudice. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, it's conceded that the instruction that was given accurately stated the law. And we also know, no pun intended, that the instruction that was given did point or focus on the fact that the jury was dealing with accomplice testimony. So where's the prejudice?
The jury instruction, as given by the trial judge, focused the jury on Quinn Martin's testimony as an alleged accomplice. That instruction was missing critical elements, that being the great caution and that the court should not rely on that testimony unless it can believe that testimony beyond reasonable doubt.
I understand that, but your position must necessarily be that although the instruction as given was legally adequate, it was still fatally prejudicial not to include the additional elements that you say should have been included.
That's
How do you
one,
get there?
I'm sorry, that's one piece of it, Your Honor.
Sorry?
That's one piece. The second piece is you have Aaron Ray, who provides, in the state's view, in closing arguments, critical testimony that proves Rashawn Owens' guilt of the robbery on March 28th, and there is no instruction on how to view his particular testimony. And when you consider he is an individual who was initially charged in the state of Pennsylvania relating to the receiving stolen property, that he is an individual who changed his story because he's shown bank surveillance photos in which he thinks, wow, this person in this bank surveillance photo committing this robbery really looks like me. I better come up with something. And that's when he points to Rashawn Owens.
So you're bifurcating this failure to request bland instruction argument is between the two accomplices? I'm not sure I grasped that from your brief.
It's both. It's that the instruction was missing certain elements, and that it should have also referenced.
But the question I asked was basically conceptual, and therefore not dependent on what happened or what was done in the case of either of the accomplices. And again, the question is if the instruction is adequate as a legal matter, then how can there be prejudice, even though the instruction might have been more favorably worded in a perfect world for your client?
This case also raises a claim of prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, that's
how I get to the prejudice in addition. That when you couple those two.
Before you go to that, can you explain to me your earlier comment that the accomplice's testimony was uncorroborated? Is there, in your view, no other evidence of Owens' guilt other than Quinn Martin's testimony?
Correct. There is no evidence of his guilt of any crime other than potentially the receiving stolen property. And it's every fact to which Ray and Martin testified, going to Ray's girlfriend's house to sort money, going to Atlantic City for multiple days to change, and gambling at all of these casinos, going to Troy Wiley's house and dropping off the gun. No witness corroborated any of that. Being in Pennsylvania, at this purported barbecue and burying some of the money, according to Ray, after the fact. None of that's ever corroborated. But the state argued that when you take Ray and Martin and put them together, and what we know being the collective knowledge of the state and these two particular individuals, the inference was that Mr. Owens was guilty of the robbery on March 28th.
Is there any truth to the assertion in the Superior Court opinion that the physical description of one of the robbers matched Mr. Owens?
The three individuals that were involved in this case as a cast of characters, meaning Martin, Ray, and Owens, were all generally of the same physical description. The bank tellers had descriptions ranging from 5'4" to 6'3". Other than a height and a fair-skinned black male, that was the only description that was given by the bank tellers from the two. And the height varied from 5'4" to 6'3".
What about the evidence that the three, that is Ray, Martin, and Owens, were found in the same car, that the dyed bills that had been stolen or some of them were in the trunk, and that Mr. Owens had over $200 of those dyed bills in his person? Isn't that corroborating evidence?
It's corroborating evidence of receiving stolen property, but it's more than 7 days after the bank robberies.
So why can't one infer from those facts alone, apart from, you know, that there may be a receiving stolen property offense, that there was involvement in the robbery itself?
One can infer that, provided, or at least in combination with, the ability for the jury to assess the credibility of the individuals who are testifying to an involvement beyond that. And that's exactly what Ray and Martin did.
So you seem to be, you're going back to the instruction.
Correct.
So we have basically a dog chasing its tail. You can't start at any one place without considering everything together?
Well, the starting place is the testimony of Ray and Martin. And they come in and they say, Owens is involved.
Well, your whole position rests on the proposition that there is, that the conviction here was based on the uncorroborated testimony of two accomplices. The response and the finding of the court was that it was corroborated. And there are factual findings by the court, one of which involved the money that was found on Owens' person, of different instances of corroboration. Are you attacking the adequacy of those factual findings?
Yes, because Ray is found in possession of the exact same red dye-stained money at the Aston car wash. Well, and he is never charged with the robberies in Delaware.
Well, let's approach it a different way, if I can follow up on Justice Jacobs' questions. Let's assume Ray and Martin did not testify, yet the police had found Owens in possession of the red-stained money that was obtained and identifiable as being money from the bank robbery, and Owens matched the description generally given by the bank tellers of someone who may have participated. Do we not still have in Delaware a presumption that if you're found in possession of stolen property, that you have stolen it, a rebuttable presumption, more than an inference?
There is.
Well, It seems to me, just because, one could argue, just because Martin and Ray testified about being in possession of the stolen money, that independent of their testimony, Owens was in possession of the stolen money, and that corroborates a story by an accomplice that he participated in the robbery, doesn't it?
The question is whether it corroborates that he participated in the robbery.
Yeah, if you begin with the premise that under Delaware law, if one is found in possession of stolen property, there's a presumption that they participated in the theft, regardless of the circumstances of the theft. If here Owens was found in possession of red dye-stained money taken specifically from this bank during a robbery, apart from Martin and Ray testifying, isn't that independent corroboration that he participated in the robbery? Just because Martin and Ray testified about it doesn't taint the fact he was found in possession and subject to that presumption, does it?
It does not. There were facts, however, in this case that were elicited at trial regarding whether, in fact, Owens was in possession, because that was not accounted for by the officer on any evidence log. One officer came in and said, yes, when I searched him, I found it, but I think I put it on the roof of the car. I'm not sure what happened to it. So there was that issue. The second issue was the only one officer.
But those issues have been resolved against your client by the jury verdict, right?
They have. But if it was only that evidence, although there's a rebuttable presumption, there was certainly counter evidence to the idea that he was involved in those robberies.
You're in your rebuttal. Did you want to save your time?
I do. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I, of course, take issue with a number of my colleague's statements, and first and foremost, that there was no corroboration. Obviously, the three, including Mr. Owens, was caught 1 week after the robbery with the proceeds of the robbery, which included marked bills, bills with security numbers, so serial numbers have been written down on, so it was definitely money taken from that particular robbery. So this is not a case in which we have the solely uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice establishing guilt. Significantly, for the first robbery, there were two robberies charged and tried. The first robbery on February 28th hinged solely on the uncorroborated testimony of Mr. Martin, and the jury found the defendant not guilty. Now, as to the instruction that was given, which the jury apparently took to heart, this was the type of instruction that was approved by this court years ago in Bordley, that it was an accomplice, an instruction based on the pattern jury instruction to view the accomplice's testimony, specifically the accomplice's testimony, not a general instruction, as was the case in Smith, for example. In Smith, it was the general testimony of all witnesses. In Boardman, in this case, it was the specific instruction directed at the accomplice, Quinn Martin, and outlining the reasons why you should view this specially because of the plea agreement. He gets a deal in exchange for testimony with the state and so on. So,
The other side points out that that instruction left out Aaron Ray. Is that a mistake, or is it?
Well, he was not an accomplice to the robbery. Aaron Ray, I mean, there's no accessory after the fact rule of law anymore. Ray came in a week afterwards, after the two had left Atlantic City and were still trying to get rid of the money, and any crime he committed, which was he was charged by the Aston police with receiving stolen property, which is his crime alone. So he was not an accomplice to these people as far as the robbery goes. So, and of course, there was no request for an instruction as to Mr. Ray either. I think my colleague places a little too much emphasis on Mr. Ray. Obviously, the primary witness here was Mr. Martin. Mr. Ray added some corroboration to that. My colleague points out that Mr. Ray, after being shown these security camera videos, got a little nervous that maybe he was going to get hammered for the robbery, and that's when he came clean. Those security camera videos, the officer was asked, chief investigating officer was asked, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst kind of video and 10 being the best, where would you rank these? And he said, I'll give it a 3. In other words, you couldn't make much out at all. the none of the victims could identify these individuals. As far as the second robbery, the March 28th, Mr. Owens was wearing a ski mask. Sarah Arnold, who was the customer service representative confronted by Mr. Martin, just didn't look at him. She was frightened. None of the three tellers could identify, or the tellers who were involved in the February 28th could identify anybody. And as far as that 5'4", that particular teller said, "I'm 5'4", and he was taller." She didn't say he was 5'4". He said he was taller than me, and I'm 5'4". So the general description seemed to be roughly about 6 feet, which about all you could tell is that there were two guys, and they were roughly about 6 feet, and all three of these individuals, Owen, Mr. Martin, and Mr. Ray, were all about 6 feet, all about the same age, all about the same build. There could be no identification by the witnesses or from these very poor security camera videotapes.
Well, doesn't that then undercut the claim?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't that undercut any claim of corroboration as a result of the security camera or the teller testimony?
No, exactly. They couldn't say who was involved. Now, I'm saying the primary corroboration here is the fact that Mr. Owens was found with the money along with the other two a week after the robbery. That's the primary corroboration. This was not solely on the testimony. This conviction was not based solely on the testimony of Mr. Martin, the accomplice. He was found with the property, and it's a legitimate inference to make from recent possession of recently stolen property that the one in possession actually took that property. So
if the telling corroboration then, that you phrased as primary, but if the telling corroboration is the fact that he was found in possession of the stolen money, if I understand the appellant's argument correctly, it is okay, fine, then he may be guilty of receiving stolen property, but the fact that he was in possession of stolen property serves no way to corroborate evidence that he actually committed the robbery.
Yes,
and that's what he was charged with in Delaware.
I disagree with my colleague on that point entirely. In other words, evidence of guilt does not have to be inconsistent with every other inference that can be made, and this is a point this Court has made many times, as long as it's also consistent with the inference in this case that he did the bank robbery. No, he could have been. No, it's another inference that could be made, is that he's only guilty, like Mr. Ray, of receiving stolen property. And
but that's a jury argument.
That's a jury argument. Yeah. But it is a legitimate inference to make that he was the one who participated in the robbery itself. So I disagree strongly with my colleague on that particular point.
But based on the way you characterize the tape, the testimony of the what you refer to as victims, and clearly they were victim of a robbery, whoever may have committed it, what was necessary under our law to appropriately caution the jury that the primary evidence that he actually committed the robbery was given by accomplices, and that they should regard accomplice testimony with caution, or consider it carefully, or consider it at least with a higher level of scrutiny than other evidence?
Yeah, the instruction that the trial judge gave in this Court, one that actually focuses on the specific accomplice as opposed to the general credibility of witnesses instruction. And the judge did give that instruction here as a specific instruction to the jury to look at the testimony of Mr. Martin as opposed to everybody else.
Well, Mr. Donnelly, can you reconcile our cases, make them whole cloth? Bland, Bordley, and Smith, is there a way of saying there is a logical analysis, a principled analysis of when one must ask for and when a court must give the cautionary instruction?
I can not entirely. I can distinguish Smith on the basis that that was the general instruction and there was no specific instruction.
And in Smith, there is no corroboration of any kind, at least the opinion says so, correct?
Yes. Bland, the original case, specifically zeroes in on the no corroboration whatsoever. And it's actually in Bland, the court also pointed out that there was testimony of two accomplices. They were conflicting in certain respects. And so the Bland instruction, that's where the language suspicion and great caution comes from. This court later in Hoskins noted that, as in Smith, these cases are going to, exactly what kind of instruction is going to depend on the facts of the individual case, whether, and certainly one of the factors to consider is whether there's any corroboration at all or not. Another Bland factor would be a case of the multiple accomplices testimony, whether these testimonies of these individuals are conflicting. But this court has, and I believe it's in, I think Hoskins involved a general. Now, I may be getting this mixed up, but one of them, I believe it was Hoskins, involved a general as opposed to a specific accomplice testimony.
Wasn't the instruction here the identical instruction in Solomon that this court upheld?
Solomon was the Solomon and Bordley were the, and Cabrera was the basically the pattern jury instruction on the specifically, as in this case, on the directed to the accomplice testimony as opposed to the general credibility of witness instruction, which is directed towards every witness who has testified without signaling out the accomplice for special consideration. It was the general instruction in Smith that the court found wanting under the specific facts of that case, under the Strickland standard. That was a motion for post-conviction. Yes.
Would we all be better served if the court announced a bright line rule that applied across the board in every situation, rather than this apparent maze that we have to work our way through to determine whether there's more than one accomplice and whether their testimony is conflicting, the extent to which there is corroborating evidence, and a different rule when there's none at all than when there is some, and the exact wording given one circumstance as opposed to another? Would we all be better served if we just had a flat rule? Whenever an accomplice testifies, the jury has to be told the following.
Well, certainly a specific decision by this court laying out what the accomplice liability instruct, which one should be given, which is probably going to be the pattern jury instruction, so that's the one that has been approved in a number of cases, and that when one need not parrot the somewhat blue language in the original suspicion and great caution, the instruction is not going to be found wanting because you say caution rather than caution.
Would it not eliminate the dance that's done about whether defense counsel should have asked for certain specific language under these circumstances, but in another case, because the circumstances are different, it wasn't wrong for defense counsel not to ask for that language?
Suppose the court may be asking whether the trial judge need give the instruction, whether defense counsel requested or not. Now, here the judge did. There was an accomplice testimony, and the judge gave an automatically gave an accomplice testimony cautionary.
Well, I'm trying to dumb it down to the absolute minimum standard. There is language. Every time an accomplice testifies and the state relies on that testimony and argues that it's relevant to convict, the judge must give this instruction.
That would be a bright line. Certainly be a bright line.
Would it be the right thing to do?
Would it be a practical help,
and is it good policy to do that?
That's, Your Honor, you're going beyond my pay grade here.
Well, unfortunately, whatever you're paid, you're here now, and it's your question.
Indeed. What I like about my job is I get to argue them one case at a time, and I don't have to look at the larger problems down the road too much.
Depends on how much you like arguing the same thing over and over in different circumstances.
I understand. The court has made the point, I think it was both in Smith and in Hoskins, that sometimes it's good to have some flexibility to look at the kind of the situation and to see in one case whether it was prejudicial or not. And this is going to be important, of course, in post-conviction when you're looking under the Strickland standard. Yeah. So, and the court did reject, I think, several times. You know, we're not saying, even Smith said, we're not saying this is a per se rule of prejudice. When defense counsel fails to request the instruction, the judge fails to give the instruction, and we're on post-conviction claiming that defense counsel was per se ineffective under the Strickland standard, and we don't even have to look at prejudice. And in that kind of case, I think the court would want to look at the prejudice and look at exactly, for example, what kind of corroboration was there of the accomplice testimony? Was this solely the accomplice's testimony? Were there conflicts, as was the case in Bland, between the testimony of different accomplices? So plenty of factors that can come in when the court's examining this issue under the Strickland standard that the court, I think, would want to maintain a certain flexibility. Now, and again, even on direct appeal, in a case where, say, the judge, if the court says this instruction shall be given and for some reason the judge doesn't give it, well, the court may want to look at the facts and circumstances of the case again and say, well, in this case there was ample corroboration. Now, it may be in a case such as no corroboration whatsoever, per se reversible error. I don't know. I mean, this is just okay. Lots of problems.
In the few minutes you have left, did you want to address the prosecutorial misconduct argument?
Unless the court, I think the one of the cases the court handed me and the judge's, trial judge's analysis there was perfectly adequate on that issue.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Donovan began his argument with a reference to Bland and that the focus in Bland was on no corroboration. And then, in essence, conceded that the corroborating factor was that Rashawn Owens is found in possession of red Tri-State money. The problem is that so was Aaron Ray, and that evidence alone equally inculpates Ray in the robbery as it could be argued that it would for Rashawn Owens. The uselessness of the video footage, because of its poor quality, also highlights the critical nature of Ray and Martin's testimony and the requirement that the jury instruction specifically reference not only great caution, but that the jury should find Rashawn Owens not guilty unless that testimony can be believed beyond a reasonable doubt. In Bland, the court said the instruction should be X when the evidence rests primarily on uncorroborated testimony. And the factual analysis that's going to be required in every case.
That word primarily in the opinion?
It is. And therefore, that will require this court to engage in that factual analysis every time, as opposed to the analysis that would be required if this court simply articulated the bright line test when it should be given. That is exactly what happened in Hoskins. This court said a portion of the evidence that was admitted, and therefore the court again is engaging in the factual analysis because there's no bright line test that yes, it must be given, and this is what the instruction should say. I mean, the historical perspective is Bland is announced and then slightly modified in Cabrera by taking great out, great caution. Then there's a revised pattern instruction, and it's created this mess, so to speak, when the court has the opportunity in this case to go back to the Bland instruction and say, this is when it's given, this is what it should say. And in this particular case, based on the lack of corroboration, it absolutely should have been given in this case.
But at least as to Martin, the actual instruction given here is identical to the one in Solomon. I mean, that was Judge Tolliver's case. This is Judge Tolliver's case. One could infer he's got a form file that uses this instruction because it's been upheld by this court.
And
is that accurate?
It is accurate, but the court in Solomon utilized the test that the question is whether that jury instruction undermined the jury's ability to intelligently perform its duty in returning a verdict. And factually, this case is different than Solomon because Ray is not mentioned, and he is absolutely critical. When the state gets to closing argument, it is the consistency between Martin's testimony and Ray's testimony that is corroborative of the state's theory that Owens participated in the robberies, and you can draw the inference
The state says that Ray is not an accomplice to the robbery. That's undisputed.
It's not undisputed. That was...
To the robbery.
I mean, this case was defended by trial counsel with three individuals are found with money, two individuals give self-serving statements, and point, at least by the end, by the time we get to trial, to Rashawn Owens. It is equally likely that Ray was the one involved and not Rashawn Owens, and that these self-serving statements, in addition to other evidence, points to Ray and Martin being the individuals that were involved, not Owens. So it's not conceded that he was not involved in the robberies.
One could surmise that if the rebuttable presumption that you stole the money if you're found in possession of it within a reasonable period of time after the theft, why wouldn't that presumption apply to Ray if it applies to Martin and to Owens?
Exactly, which is when Mr. Donovan argued that the primary corroboration is the fact that Owens is in money, is in possession of that red dye-stained money, it equally inculpates Ray.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.